From the Paley Center for Media in New York, this is Max Media. Here's Max Robbins.
Hello, everybody. Here we are once again, Max Media, the show that pulls the veil back on how the media actually works. Today, our guest is Charles Aaron, the music editor of Spin Magazine and one of the most erudite critics of music, modern music, and I mean really modern, I know, and really a keen observer of the business as a whole. Charles, nice to see you.
Good to see you, Max.
On a very snowy day. Listen, the music industry, I mean, you've been covering this for what now, 20 years?
Well, yeah. I have been making somewhat of a living for about 20 years now.
No mean feat. And more than a decade at Spin.
Yeah, I've been sitting at a desk editing for about 10 years, and I was writing freelance and on contract for about 5 years before that. So basically, the grunge era to the present.
From grunge to infinity.
So I watched it rise astronomically and absurdly, ridiculously, and then crash in a similar fashion. So it's been it's an interesting ride.
I would say,
The cars we've been using, the rental cars we've been using have declined precipitously over the years.
It is interesting in that you kind of the arc of your own career has really kind of followed the state of the music industry from where it was incredibly robust, you know, grunge revitalized rock and roll, basically, and a lot of people made a lot of money, and an incredibly robust business in the sale of CDs to where we are now. I mean, maybe you could talk a little bit about where we are now and maybe where we're going.
Well, the most generous way to put it is that it's a very transitional period. For the record industry, it's a disaster. For the music industry, it's definitely a time of transition and opportunity. And for everyone like me who's involved in the media or anybody in any of the ancillary aspects of the music business, music industry, there's a lot of opportunity and transition. The recorded music industry, the large labels who sell CDs, are basically dead in the water. There's not much they can do in terms of reaching the financial heights they had in the late 90s. In the mid to late 90s, they were selling millions and millions and millions of CDs. There was not a single. There was not an MP3 file. There was no way to access a hit song. So if you had a hit song, say like Who Let the Dogs Out by the Baha Men.
Can't get enough of that.
You had to buy the album. Nobody wants to do that, but you had to do it. 4 to 5 million albums were sold of the Baha Men. They, you know, are still living off that money. And that happened right before downloading really kicked in. And then after that, if you had a hit single, you could probably sell maybe 500,000 off of that. Because, you know, most people, either because they didn't have the computer capability or the knowledge, weren't going to be able to download, say, a Stacey's Mom.
Right.
Which was
right.
was a novelty hit after that.
Right, right.
And those guys,
Fountains of Wayne was the band.
Fountains of Wayne, who were quite an okay band. They built a career off one song, but it was nowhere close to what, say, the Baha Men or NSYNC or any of these bands could do. They had one hit, they sold 500,000 records, and then they declined. And after that, say 2000 was the breaking point. And after that, people were with just, you know, precipitous increase, were buying less and less CDs because they could download the songs they wanted to hear. One or two good songs on an album. You know, if you heard, say, whatever the 2003 equivalent of Nelly's Country Grammar was.
Right.
And you're like, I love that song. Then you're going to probably figure out how to download it. You're not going to buy the album. Or people don't want to buy the album. So you and the industry, of course, saw that they could, at one point, say 1998, said sell 10 million copies of Kid Rock. They want to sell 10 million copies of a Kid Rock in perpetuity. They right. feel like that's the way it should be. And then 5 years later, whoever the equivalent of Kid Rock is, say just, you know, a flashy guy with a shtick and a few pop songs and an audience, they're thinking, why can't we sell even half that much? People are stealing this music from us. And this is, and this is just a very disturbing state of affairs. And they couldn't figure out what to do about it. They viewed downloading and MP3s as the enemy.
And they're really downright thievery. I mean, that was taking food off their children's.
Yeah, and it was ruining their business. They looked at it and they equated it in print as child pornography. They called it that. And our friend Hillary Rosen, who was the head of the Record Industry Association of America, who's now a Democratic lobbyist and has had a very checkered career and did more than anyone as the head of the record business at that time to criminalize in everyone's mind this quite natural activity. It was very natural for kids, particularly at colleges where they have access to computers with a
high-speed connections.
It made all the sense in the world for them to be able to click on something and hear a song, even just one time, to see if they liked it, rather than going to even a cool record store and buying the whole album to hear it. It made no sense. And the record industry, because they couldn't make a lot of money off of singles, had, in the 90s, eliminated singles. And there was just no delivery system for a song. It didn't exist. They got rid of singles. They got rid of CD singles. They tried EPs. They couldn't figure out how to make a ton of money off of the single. So they eliminated it, and they created the desire for downloading in a way.
Wow. You know, just a little fact here. Digital individual track sales were up 27% from last year. That was breaking the 1 billion mark for the first time at 1.07 billion. That's all through iTunes, basically. I mean, iTunes comes in a couple of years later, and that's the game changer, isn't it?
Well, Napster completely flipped everything around in 1999-2000 because they created a clearinghouse for downloading, the way you could access. For a variety of reasons, they weren't really able to cash in on that at that point, and they kind of went bankrupt after a few years. But Steve Jobs came in after that with iTunes and basically just created the best interface and the best way of accessing MP3s and digital files. And the record industry at that point was so desperate and were kind of freaking out, and they didn't know. They didn't understand what was happening. They didn't understand what Steve Jobs was talking about half the time. And so basically they gave away the farm to him. They put not really that many restrictions on like how many times you could copy songs that you got on iTunes, how many iPods you could transfer those songs to. They kind of were just like, can't take it anymore. We don't want to negotiate with you. You're smarter than us. We have been trying to develop what you have for years, and we've failed miserably. So if you can do it, do it. And so companies like Universal, which probably could have negotiated in a few more restrictions on how much their music could get copied, just said, the hell with it. You know, go do your thing, and we'll take our 60 cents off your 99-cent song. And
at least we're getting something.
We're getting something. We're cratering here like mad. And they finally, I think at the point they made the deal with iTunes, basically the deal to all the major record companies allowed iTunes to put their songs up. I mean, they'd sort of given up on the whole CD thing, like their dream, you know, their utopia of the late 90s when you're buying a $17 CD and they're making $10 to $12 off each CD and you're selling $10 million of total garbage acts. And I mean, the amount of money being made is ungodly. So by this point, by the mid-2000s, or 2003, 2004, they've given up.
Wow.
And so they gave it to iTunes, and now iTunes is selling an enormous amount of music, and it's great. But it's not great for music, the record industry.
The traditional music industry. I mean, the top-selling album in 2008 was Lil Wayne Carter's
Carter 3.
Yeah, 2.8 million copies. The top-selling album in 1998 was the Titanic soundtrack. I know you bought several copies of that, both for yourself and friends, which sold 9 million. Do you think we're ever going to see 9 million in sales of a CD again? Of a suite of songs, if you will?
I mean, it's you can never say never with technology, but it just feels like an alien invasion is probably more likely than anything that would that would create an environment like that. And I think, in the large sense, looking outside of my own paycheck, perhaps, I think it's great. I mean, the access to music is so vast, and people are kind of pursuing their own interests in music. That's the thing. It's hard now to kind of have a Nirvana or to have a group where millions and millions of people are focused on that group, and that group represents a culture, and a lot of people feel like this one act represents them, because people are kind of exploring all their different interests with downloading and everything, and the record industry isn't forcing people to listen to stuff on the radio, because people don't really listen to the radio, terrestrial radio, that much. It's kind of hard to like channel and direct music listeners in the same way where you will get a mega blockbuster like that. I mean, something like Lil Wayne, I mean, he's, I guess, in his mid to late 20s now. He's been making music for more than a decade. He's a very talented guy, and he built up over many, many years a following. He released tons of mixtapes that got a following. And so, sure, maybe 10 years ago he would have sold twice that much, but you know, I mean, it's unfair to him to look at him as like, oh, that's a disappointing result.
It's because, still living for Lil
because
Wayne.
Because Lil Wayne's a weirdo. He's a completely he's a completely cuckoo, like almost outsider artist, you know, who nobody understands what he's talking about half the time. He's high all the time. His beats are completely random and cheap sounding half the time. And so for somebody like that to sell 3 million is a great testament to him. The fact that the record industry looks at Lil Wayne as the high watermark is fairly ridiculous and a depressing prospect for them.
This is Max Media. I'm here with our guest today, Charles Aaron, the music editor of Spin Magazine. We've been talking about the state of the music industry. Certainly, the state of that industry has a direct impact on what you do. Spin Magazine, you've been there through many incarnations, different owners, different editors and chiefs. I mean,
many different.
You're a survivor. How does Spin Magazine, both in that print, as that print vehicle, and wherever else it may appear online, its website, whatnot, how does it stay relevant?
Well, it's definitely a challenge. I think it's always been a challenge for Spin, even in the beginning when it was founded basically as a younger alternative to Rolling Stone in the mid-'80s, and which was long overdue. If it hadn't been Spin, it would have been somebody else. I mean, there was a whole generation of kids who came up on music in the 80s that wasn't pop music, and there was a lot of great music that was being ignored by Rolling Stone and all media in America pretty much on a certain level. And so Spin came along and kind of rode that. But Spin's always kind of had like a, we're the mainstream, but we're not. We're a big business, but we're not. We're cool, but we'll sell you stuff. I mean, we've always existed in this middle ground, which has allowed people like me to kind of like write a lot of what I want and to have freedom and kind of walk a lot of lines in a way that you just can't do at Rolling Stone or a lot of other publications. And so Spin has always kind of been on this inside-outside track. And so even during the 90s when Spin basically took credit for foreseeing grunge in some way, or like we were the Bible of alternative music and we saw it coming and we championed it first and we wrote it the hardest and all that. And then when the record industry really boomed in the 90s, you know, we tried to take advantage of that by becoming a little more pop, putting people on the cover maybe that we weren't necessarily that convinced of artistically, but hey, you know, the opportunity's there. And so I think Spin basically in a business sense peaked in the late 90s, just like the music business. And I think a lot of times people say, well, the music business is crashing, so they're not advertising as much, and so that really damages music magazines. And that's not really true. I mean, that's not the relationship that we're talking about. It's not, you know, Universal is not giving us enough ad dollars anymore, so we're in big trouble. I don't think that's the problem. I mean, I think the problem with music journalism now, and we're all, music magazines are in just as bad a trouble as music, major music labels. We're all cratering. Our sales have gone way down and our ad dollars have gone way down. I think the main problem is people became music fans and young music fans and kids who were, say, in their teen years and their 20s in the late 90s became suspicious of major labels. And they became suspicious of anybody who was associated with that. So or they saw associated with that.
So a spin has strayed
into an area where I think we were putting people like Creed on the cover or Kid Rock, who none of us on staff liked. I hated those people. And and they represented everything that I had been working against for years. And so then we're Limp Bizkit we're throwing on the cover. And you know, and as an editor, you're like, as an editor-in-chief, they're like, wow, these people are selling 5 to 10 million records, and they're sort of alternative. We'll throw them on the cover. But I think what happened was a lot of readers over time began to view Spin as not really that much different from Rolling Stone, as just another arm of the major commercial music business. And so I think there became a doubt. In the same way there was a doubt about the music industry, there became a doubt about music magazines of any size.
So you were losing your street cred in a sense.
And so basically, I think we're just losing our credibility in a way. And and it's the same dilemma. You know, Spin was fat in the late 90s in the sense of like many pages. Some of those magazines were thick in the late 90s. And of course, when you own the company, and there's a whole back history with who owns Spin and why we needed to make a certain amount of money. But you look at that and you want that. In the same way that somebody wants to keep selling 10 million Kid Rocks, somebody still wants to keep selling, you know, 45% on the newsstand of your Limp Bizkit issue. You want to keep maintaining that. And so we all got caught up, I think, a little bit in how much money we were making. And Spin did make a good bit of money. Unfortunately, you know, our business practices were a little suspect, and we were not making as much money as we probably should have to carry us now. But I think everybody got a little too fat and happy, and a new generation of kids came along and said, "We can't trust these people. You know, they're just covering all this stuff because they think they're supposed to." And even though there may have been a lot of great stuff in Spin, and there was on the margins.
I mean, you had some great people writing for it.
We had
David Eggers.
Well, whatever. but you know, you have like with electronic music or underground music or punk music, whatever form it took, we were covering all that, independent hip-hop, all this stuff that was very important and that I was mostly trying to write about. As opposed to doing a cover story on Green Day for the third time or something. You know, that stuff even though it kept us credible, wasn't making us money. And you could never make the argument to your boss that by say, covering like an underground hip-hop group like Company Flow that I really loved and I wrote about a bunch of times, I can't make the argument that's putting any food on anybody's table or even justifying my existence as a music editor.
On the other hand, you're getting a lot of competition now digitally. I mean, anybody with a high-speed connection and open-source software can be a music critic. And you have, for example, Pitchfork, which just kind of, you know, blew up a couple years, huge, as real competitors and kind of having that cred that it sounds like you guys are had to fight pretty hard to win back.
Well, I think Spin had drifted in a lot of ways from 2000 on. We'd had different leadership. We'd had different ownership. Music was changing. New generation of fans were coming along. And Pitchfork basically capitalized on that. They did it in a bit of a kind of scattershot way in the beginning, but there was such an opportunity there and there was such a hunger from younger fans to read something different. And, you know, alt weeklies were declining, which was when I was coming up was a home for music writing.
I mean,
and coverage.
Village Voice, LA Weekly, those were tip sheets.
Yeah, that was where I wanted to write when I came out of college, and that's where I did write. And I think all the people who used to like look at Spin as an opportunity, or used to look at The Voice, or the LA Weekly, or any of the other, the Bay Guardian, or any of the other places, began to look at Pitchfork. And you know, it was very hit and miss, just because there wasn't the editing that you got at other places. I both under and overstate that. I think maybe. I don't know. As an editor, I appreciate something that's been edited. And clearly, the majority of things that were on Pitchfork were not edited. But on the other hand, the freedom that they gave people encouraged them to write in a way that they wouldn't have been able to write elsewhere, and which is what I wanted when I was writing for the Village Voice. And going back and reading those pieces, you know, a large majority of them were totally incoherent that I wrote and that were supposedly edited. So I don't know. I mean, but anyway, Pitchfork basically came in and for 2 or 3 years, I think, really did eat away at a lot of the readers. I mean, the people may have still read Spin who read Pitchfork. I think that was still the case. People, it wasn't like an either or. But I think the enthusiasm for reading was with Pitchfork and with a lot of the music blogs, Flux Blog, you know, initially, a lot of other places like Stereo Gum now. That's where the enthusiastic reading was.
That's the real hardcore fans. There's a real, that sense of community, I think, that kind of got you into this in the first place. This is Max Media. We're talking to Charles Aaron, music editor of Spin Magazine, about all things, about where the music business is, where the music criticism is. And now we're going to talk to Charles a little bit about where he fits into all of this. You know, we got a little fun fact here, Charles. An article written called "I'm Not Charles Aaron" due to a mix-up in sending out ballots for the 2008 Paz and Jop poll. For those who don't know, that's the Village Voice poll. That's kind of where rock critics from all over the country vote. It's kind of the, or at least was kind of the gold standard of where the rock critics get together and vote on what the top releases of the year are. Every ballot that went out in 2008 said Charles Aaron. Yeah. Did you have a hand in that?
Yeah, Rob Harville of the Music Editor and I discussed that early on, and thought it would be a good way to pump up both of our, like, because he can then apologize and claim that he was doing a performance piece, and then, you know, I can seem like I'm relevant.
Speaking of relevant, another thing, there was a scientific statistical analysis that says you are the third most centrist
Centrist
music critic in America out of 576 critics polled.
That's weird.
I think what they mean by centrist is that your selections in the Paz and Jop poll
were with the majority. Well, I've put in many years of convincing all these people to think like me. I've edited their work for 10, 15 years, and it's so surprised that now they would agree with everything I've been telling them is the proper way to think. But I don't know. I joke, but that's kind of true. But I think music criticism is at a weird point. I mean, when I was writing a monthly column in the 90s, every month I would write about like the 8, 10, or 12 songs of that month that I was most excited about.
And it really was excited Charles Aaron.
And it was all across genres. It didn't have anything to do with like, this is an alternative rock magazine, you got to write about the new Pearl Jam single. It was whatever I wanted to write about. And I really, really did try to convey that I was excited to sit around and listen to this stuff and write about it for a living. And there was all this stuff that was fun, even though you couldn't download it at that point. You did have to buy a CD to get it. But hopefully it at least read as kind of a fun way of jumping across all genres and embracing whatever was fun and good. And I do feel like 10 years later, or more than 10 years later in a lot of sense, more kids think that way. They think that if it's a hip-hop song or a rock song or a disco song or country song or whatever, and it's great and it's good, their ears are open to it. And that, I think, it might make Spin less valuable in some way because we are somewhat focused on rock. But I've never been that way, and I think the Paz and Jop too is always been diverse, and it's more diverse than it's ever been. I mean,
it really goes back to tradition in the whole rise of alt radio, and when you look at the and in the music business in the 60s when it really became a business, when on the same bill you'd have a hard rock act, an avant-garde jazz act, and James Brown. I mean, the litmus test is this good?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, the famous MC5, Sun Ra shows and all that stuff. And Lollapalooza in its early days was, even though I didn't particularly like all the acts, they were very diverse. And I think that's happening now, whereas through the 90s, a lot of times it would be like it was electronic music, rock music, hip-hop music. There was a lot of critics sort of tried to walk across those genres, but I think the music business didn't. They really tried to, we sell this type of music to this type of person.
So you think the technology is
allowed? And radio, obviously. We sell this format to this type of person.
Do you think technology has allowed that kind of crossover and for the audience in a sense to have broader base taste?
Yeah. I think it's enabled a natural impulse. I think naturally, for a lot of people, a good song's a good song. And that's the way I've always looked at it. And I think now that's definitely the way people are embracing music. I think, you know, from a business standpoint, whether you're a label or a magazine, that makes it a little more complicated. You know, how do you narrow cast and sell a product? Based on a demographic or a genre, you know, you've done it in a certain way, and now you're basically, that's been blown up. And
well, I've got my favorite music critic in America here, so I want to know a few things here before we have to wrap up. One of them is, are there five artists? Or it could even be three,
mm-hmm.
or six. We're not picky here, or records that we should look forward to in 2009 that we want to. That we should be thinking about downloading now or in the next couple months.
Yeah, well, we're still locked into this magazine model where we're listening to stuff 2 months in advance, hopefully, because the magazine's got a 2 month lead time. So at the moment, I'm listening to the new Yeah Yeah Yeahs album because I have to write our lead review for an upcoming issue, and it's quite an interesting album. They kind of They were part of the early 2000s sort of rebirth of rock in New York and garage music and punk music and a reaction to electronica and dance music. And so now they're making this record many years later that's basically a dance record with no guitars. And so that's kind of interesting. But the record that everybody needs to listen to this year, just so you can be part of the conversation of music, is the Animal Collective record, whether you like it or not. And I love it, and I've been listening to it ever since November of last year.
And what kind of music is it for some of our audience?
It's not possible to describe. You have to listen to it. It's very rhythmic and trippy, and it's probably more as – I mean, our review sort of even lapsed into comparing it to the Grateful Dead, even though it has nothing to do with standard rock. It's a lot of electronic loops, a lot of strange phased like music that goes in and out. Basically feels like you're on drugs. They chant a lot. They sing in kind of a one guy in the group, Panda Bear, sings a lot in a sort of a Beach Boys harmonic way. And he doubles and triples his voice. And it's kind of like music you would hear at kind of a modern rave, whatever that is. If there was a modern rave. If raving had been killed, like everything else that was fun, then you would listen to Animal Collective because it's definitely electronic, but it feels folky and organic. And the fact that I cannot really describe it after I've written about it, I've edited a review, I've read – I mean it's what everybody's talked about on blogs for months now. I can't really describe it as they're like so-and-so.
Gotcha. Fair enough.
And that's – I think why they're exciting. Every other band I would mention to you, probably, I could give you an antecedent that would be like, okay. Because I really love Anthony and the Johnsons. He's this kind of very large but delicate man who's he's gay, but his music isn't really overtly about that. But it is about sort of the kind of the pain and suffering involved, I guess, in the his lifestyle choices, but and his orientation. It's just, but it's art song. It's kind of like it goes back to Kurt Vile. It goes through, you know, even like Nico and
Velvet Underground.
It goes through a lot of traditions, cabaret, and so I when I go to see him play, I see where he's coming from. He's a pianist. He plays beautiful, like has a jazz group sort of that backs him. But with Animal Collective, I have no idea what they're doing. And if you go see them live, there's a 50% chance it'll be terrible because they improvise a lot. A lot of it is just sort of like goofing around with electronics and they're not conventional singers. So there's a lot of effects and then they get pissed off or they get bored or whatever. It's fun. I mean, it's definitely better than it used to be. But well, anyway, be forewarned. If I tell you to go to an Animal Collective show, you may hate it.
Hey, Charles, it's what I find really interesting, too, is that after all this time doing this, doing what you do, you remain really engaged and excited about some new cool stuff. I mean, how do you – I mean, I'm sure you got to wade through a lot of just crap. For lack of a better word, to get there, how do you stay engaged?
Yeah, no, I mean, nobody can like everything or be enthusiastic about, you know, even, you know, 10% of what you get. But, I mean, I feel fortunate to have this job. I mean, I went to journalism school. I wasn't a particularly good student. I tried to work at daily newspapers. I tried to work at trade magazines to make a living. Tried to be a sports writer. None of it worked. And with this, I get to listen to records and go to shows and talk to people about music and make a living for 15 years or more. So I really do have to be grateful for that. If I didn't feel grateful, I'd be a complete moron. I mean, I don't know what the hell else I would be doing. I really don't. So, and plus, if you don't get excited by music, it's kind of your last refuge. Like, what else is going to excite you? I mean, I find people who get bored with music and they're like, I love 30 Rock. TV's so awesome now. And I'm like, yeah, I love TV too. But TV didn't change my life the way music did when I was a kid. It doesn't really change a lot of kids' lives when they're 16. People listen to bands and they're like, oh my God, my mind is blown.
And I'm not alone.
I mean, maybe if you watch Big Love, you might go, oh, my mind is blown, you know, but there's not been a lot of TV that provided that epiphany, like Grell Marcus is always talking about the epiphanies he has. And music does that. And if you can somehow try to avoid thinking too much about your paycheck and the business and all that, then you can still have those epiphanies. You know, you don't want to try and force yourself, but they happen. And it's happened for me every year that I've been doing this. Last year, you know, there were at least a half dozen moments where I heard something and it was an epiphanous moment. So I'm happy that that still happens.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much, Charles. We got to wrap up here. Been speaking with Charles Aaron, the music editor of Spin Magazine. I'm Max Robbins. This is Max Media, and we'll be with you again real soon. Thank you.
You've been listening to Max Media, a production of the Paley Center for Media in New York City. We're on the web at paleycenter.org. That's PaleyCenter.org. And you can reach us by email at maxmedia@paleycenter.org.